Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. President George Bush, under the sketching hand of Matt Davis, has the eyebrows, ears, and cheeks of a chipmunk. John Kerry looks less like the patrician New Englander and more like a pelican in a suit. It was both the artwork and the eye of Matt Davis that caught the attention of the judges for this year's Pulitzer Prize. Matt works as editorial cartoonist at the Journal News in White Plains, New York. Now, on the West Coast, Dan Neal won his Pulitzer for car writing at the L.A. Times. So as you can imagine, this is not the automobile journalism that we have learned to endure. Test riding a heritage softtail classic Harley-Davidson, Dan describes the classic deep idling one potato, two potato, one potato, two potato sound as something that strums the homeland heartstrings like the national anthem. But his biggest worry, he writes, is that the 700-pound bike doesn't fall over when he parks it. It's hard to look like a tough biker, he says, wearing a truss. Dan Neal and Matt Davis won their Pulitzers not just because they are smart and funny, but because they're good at looking at this country and marking its strengths and its absurdities. They're both with us today. We'd like to have you in on our conversation. How important is it for you that original voices continue to be heard and celebrated in America? What are your expectations of, I don't know, the editorial cartoon or the critical writer? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And this morning, Dan Neal's joining us from the studios of KPCC in Los Angeles. Matt Davis is at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Dick. Thank you. This is Matt.
Hi, Dick.
Here.
You guys haven't met each other yet, have you?
No.
No.
No. Just here. Hi, Matt.
Well, I look forward to meeting you at the ceremony.
I'll be serving drinks,
which is something you've been doing a little bit of in the last 48 hours, I gather.
That's right,
Dan. You had some fairly tough competition. When did you find out you were going to be a finalist?
When did I find out I was a finalist?
Yeah.
Well, there's sort of an unofficial list that floats around a publication editor and publisher. And so I think I got a heads up about a month ahead that I was in the running. And this was, of course, quite gratifying in that Susan Lucci kind of way. But I was floored when I found out I won.
And Matt, about the same lead time for you?
Ditto on what Dan just said. I saw it on editor and publisher, the official unofficial leak, and I was gratified, and then really terrified for the next month. Because you kind of got to completely discount the fact that you don't want to actually think you're going to win it,
especially when you're up against people like Gary Trudeau.
Yeah, no kidding. I just assumed it was going to be him or the other guy whose name was Steve Sack and is also an amazing, phenomenal editorial cartoonist. He's with the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and I literally, as far as I was concerned, on Monday, there was absolutely no way that it was going to be my name that was going to get pulled out of the hat. And I'm still floored. I can't believe I'm even being interviewed on the radio right now about it.
Dan Neal, you were so sure that you were going to be accepting congratulations for the Pulitzer that you booked yourself a ticket to the car show in New York. That's where you're supposed to be, right?
That's right. How'd you know that?
Never mind. We have good researchers here.
Yeah, no, I was supposed to show up with a what I thought was a well-prepared hangdog look for having lost the Pulitzer in New York today. But drat, my plans are foiled again.
Matt, let me talk just a little bit about the work that you do. I happen to have in front of me a sheaf of your latest work. In fact, the one from yesterday's Journal News of this I was going to use the word rodent-looking person. But
your
I'll
words,
let you
not
say
mine.
That.
No. I just draw George Bush the way he looks,
He's standing by a door in the smoking rubble of what is labeled as Iraq, and all that's left is the standing door with the words U.S. exit on it, and the caption, as you can see, the date still stands. It's the sort of thing that you have to pull almost directly from that day's news.
Yeah, absolutely. That one was particularly a unique cartoon for me because I was so full of adrenaline on Monday because I was, as I you know, said before, I was terrified about the outcome of. I was just convinced I wasn't going to win the Pulitzer, but I still had to sit there and come up with a cartoon that day. And that, I did draw that one on Monday, and I really wanted to get it done before 3 o'clock, which I never do. Normally, I drag the whole thing out. You know, it takes. I'm usually out by 6 o'clock. And so that particular cartoon, you know, I was reading the newspaper in between, adrenaline rushes and panic, and so it was that was a very unusual cartoon. I was actually, frankly, I'm as amazed, I'm almost as amazed that I got that cartoon done as I was that I won the Pulitzer. So,
there are cartoons that you do that don't exactly get the love and adulation that the Pulitzer people have heaped on you. Here, I should point out to our listeners that you were the first winner of the Herblock Prize editorial cartooning a little bit earlier this year. And again, our crack research team was able to find your acceptance speech from that, during which, Mr. Davis, you quote a letter to your own editor in which the unnamed correspondent says, "Davis is fanatically insensitive, insulting, intolerant, libelous, offensive, and seditious, but not provocative. He viciously impugns the reputations of others through vile bias attacks from which he arrogantly expects no response or serious consequences." I don't think I want that person as a writer on my program, but I think he will.
Signed, Mom.
My mom swears she didn't write that.
Do you get a lot of mail like that?
Not like that. Usually, I mean, that was an interesting letter in that I pulled that one out. I thought it would, you know, for effect, obviously. Most people who actually put pen to paper actually think about what they're going to write, and they'll put up an argument against me that's sometimes, you know, mostly pretty well reasoned. And that particular letter, the guy actually was that was a letter to my publisher, and he was insisting that I be fired, and he didn't actually. I mean, that was the tenor of the letter, what you just read there, and he never actually gave any argument against what I'd done. You know, the cartoons. I don't even know what cartoons he was upset about, but I think he even called me. He called me un-American too, which is really funny because I don't know if you noticed, I'm not originally from America, so I thought that was pretty amusing too.
Do you smile when you get that kind of mail? I mean, is that a little bit of what you want to do?
I don't enjoy that aspect of there are editorial cartoonists who gleefully like upsetting people. That's not really my business. I prefer sort of getting the truth out. I just basically read the newspaper and I see, you know, the same news that everybody else does, and I have my own opinion on you know, the way things should be, and I just try and translate them into a drawing. As far as sort of upsetting people, I just I'm not comfortable with it at all, and I hate talking to people on the phone when they're mad, because you know, I like friendly conversations, you know. And generally, actually it's kind of sport for me when people actually take the time to call, which is always suspect, because I've never ever called a newspaper to complain about anything before. So the idea of like calling to complain about a cartoon is amusing to me. I couldn't imagine finding the time to do that, but it's a sport for me. I always try to kind of smooth the feathers of the reader over and end up being friends. It's never failed so far.
Matt, I want to sit tight for half a sec while I talk to Dan about his work as an automobile writer with the Los Angeles Times. You've, of course, had this job for a long, long time, Dan.
At the LA Times?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, since September.
And before that, you were doing what?
I was freelancing for, mostly Car and Driver magazine, and I also wrote for the automobile section as a contributor for the New York Times.
I've got you marked down here as spending time in the classified section of newspaper days. Is that?
Yes. Let's get in the Wayback Machine. Yeah. When I first started writing about cars for the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina,
is listening to you right now. I want you to know your fan base there is a big part of our program. But anyway,
shout out to the NNO. Yo, give me some love. Anyway, I actually was hired in the classified advertising department which was produced an advertorial section, and I started writing columns for them, which didn't actually turn out to be all that advertorial in tone or content. In fact, you know, I got a lot of letters like Matt. But to the everlasting credit of the director of classified advertising at the News and Observer, a man named Durwood Kennedy, you know, they stuck by me. And, you know, I mean, we had advertisers who would, you know, would come in just ranting and raving and wanting my hide. And, you know, they figured it was a very measured calculation, but he decided that it was better for the readers, better for the advertisers to have something that the readers would, you know, come to see, and they'd stay for the ads. And that was, and I worked for them for 7 years before I finally went too far.
What do you mean, went too far?
Well, I just, you know, I kept pushing the envelope.
You're not allowed to talk about panties in the rubbish as a way of describing a really fast car, or what?
It was, there was a community standards issue at stake. But basically what happened was that, you know, I wrote these columns for 7 years. I never had an editor. No one even read it. I had this unfettered access to the presses for all these years, and which was great. You know, I think that's one of the it's the secret to my mediocrity is that that I had this open forum, and so finally, you know, it just got too crazy. The column was just way out, and so they said, we're going to have somebody read behind you. And I declined to do that because one of the people they wanted to read behind me was the director of classified automotive advertising. In other words, vetting it by the advertising boss, actually the person I work for. And as I said, this I declined to do, and eventually I was fired for what I have come to call principled insubordination.
No sense of nya-nya-nya going through your mind these last couple of days.
Absolutely not. The News and Observer is an absolutely fantastic newspaper, and I work for great people, and Durwood Kennedy's a saint.
I have to tell you both that we have been in the Connection office with our vast crew of researchers and producers, been passing around copies of the Matt Davis cartoons and the automotive writing of Dan Neal, and having a lot of fun with it. There are some of Matt's cartoons on our website. I encourage you to take a look at them there. We're at www.theconnection.org. And we have some links to Dan's work. In fact, we'll get a chance when we come back after the break to talk a little or to hear a little bit of a feature piece, Fantasy in High Gear, courtesy of Mr. Neal. But Connection listeners, an invitation to you to join my conversation this hour. We're going to turn it when we come back after the break to talk a little bit about what it is the job of the critical eye is in America now. It doesn't really matter whether you're drawing a daily editorial cartoon or writing features for the automotive section of the newspaper. You have to be a keen observer of this country. And we're really well served when the Pulitzer Committee chooses the type of keen eye of Dan and Matt, who are with us on the program today. I need a little bit of feedback from you on whether or not that matters in your cracking of the daily paper. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're fabulous. Don't deny it. You know it's true. And yet, even with all your fabulousness, you are more or less the same, day in, day out, which can be, not to put too fine a point on it, boring. Look in the mirror. It's you again, isn't it? This is the writing of Dan Neal, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism this week. He's a guest on the program, as is Matt Davis, who won for editorial cartooning. We're going to continue on with a little bit of the Fantasy in High Gear here. Mr. Neal writes, in car-obsessed Los Angeles, a curious industry has sprung up catering to those who want to rent a fantasy ride for a day or weekend to front like a high roller in a $200,000 Lamborghini or command the best spot in valet parking with a shiny Hummer, too. Actually, three or four spots now. Dan Neal, I'm going to put you to work and have you to pick up the story here with the notion of perhaps cruising around in a Cadillac. Can you do that for me?
Sure. This story was in last week's paper. It was basically we rented four vehicles, and the idea was to be kind of an automotive zealot, to appear in different places and be different kinds of people by assuming an automotive identity. So the first thing I did is I rented a 76 Cadillac and went gay cruising in West Hollywood. So that section of the story goes like this. I'm not gay. At least I don't think I'm gay. Wait, let me look at the new Sports Illustrated. Nope, definitely not gay. Even so, I have a pretty good idea of the kind of vehicle I need to cruise Santa Monica Boulevard. A Boulevardier, naturally enough. Preferably a convertible, so I can, you know, work it. Something with a lot of style, but not too patently Nelly. No white Mazda Miata or turquoise Ford Thunderbird. Leave a guy a little mystery. I find what I'm looking for at Beverly Hills Rent-A-Car, a 1976 Cadillac Eldorado, red with a leather interior whiter than Pat Boone's shoes. I pick up the car at the agency's airport location, and it's clear the caddy is suffering fantasy fatigue. A big rubbery fissure bifurcates the dash. The proud wreath and crest emblem is crudely superglued to the wood-grain trim. The air conditioner spews warm, Freon-scented air. On the freeway, the enormous 20-foot-long Cadillac shimmies and shudders as if it were filmed in earthquake vision. To drive a nearly 30-year-old car is to appreciate the little things routinely available on modern cars, things like brakes and steering. Even so, there is no denying the Cadillac's allure.
Do we have a link to this one on our website so people can continue on? Yes, we do. It's a great piece, and I recommend it to our listeners. That's Dan Neal reading from a recent piece. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. And Dan, why cars? Why is it that you find cars are a way to focus your attention on people in general?
Well, I'd like to pretend that it was, you know, I had this, you know, broad sociological vision and, you know, and I tunneled up from that. But
this is radio. You know, this is NPR. We'll buy anything you say. You know.
Oh, okay.
That.
All right. Well, yeah. No, I wrote my thesis on cars. No, really. I wanted to write about cars because it was fun. You know, I loved cars. I loved driving fast. And so since the cars I didn't own were fast, I had to figure out a way to get in fast cars. It was all part of a larger scam, really. And but when I started writing about cars, I was surprised to find that there was a lot more to it than I think generally was appreciated, and that they said a lot about our people, certainly on an individual level. And I think if you look at the characteristics of the herd, it said a lot about the species. They are, in fact, fairly significant telltales of our society and our culture. And, you know, I don't want to put, you know, too, you know, put a pointy hat on.
I'm with you.
I mean, you know, anybody who looks at cars, who sits in traffic, you know, and they have plenty of time to think about it too, can see that what we drive says a lot about who we are. I think, well, one of the observations, this is kind of a commonplace, and I have been meaning to write about it. Feel free to steal the idea, somebody out there. You know, the fact that Americans have grown obese in the past 10 or 15 years, I want to weigh all the cars, the average weight of cars, and track it with the average weights of the of Americans, and I believe they've got to roughly correspond. So we're getting fatter, and our cars are getting fatter.
And Matt, you're listening along to this, and I know your own cartoonist mind is at work in the same kind of way that while you may be lampooning John Kerry. I mean, it's right. We're seeing ourselves, are we not, in your best work?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, when I draw a cartoon, I mean, it essentially half. I mean, I don't know exactly what the percentage is, but a lot of the cartoons I do are almost a direct challenge to the reader. You know, I mean, Dan's talking about, you know, the obesity issue. I've done cartoons on that, and it's kind of poking fun at the issue. But you know, the reader's the one who's got to sort of maybe look in the mirror and go, oh, maybe he's talking about me, or maybe that the discomfort that the humor brings, or rather, the discomfort is the humor about that. So you know, I think when I'm drawing about, say, John Kerry or George Bush, that's less about the reader and more about just those perhaps tend to be more just policy based cartoons, which actually, as dry as that sounds, those tend to be the best ones. But ultimately, it ties in the reader because everybody has an opinion on everything, and that's where I get my reaction. Is you know, I put my opinion out there, and the reader has their own set of opinions, and you know, sometimes they agree, and sometimes they clash with what I say. So, I think everything, you know, everything's based on what the reader perceives. Sure.
One of my favorites along that line is from last summer when there's a very portly little boy standing in a bicycle shop. The title on the cartoon is 5-time Tour de France Winner Inspires a Generation. And the kid's looking up at the man behind the counter saying, do you sell a Lance Armstrong video game, mister? Very clever. I like that a lot. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. With a couple of Pulitzer Prize winners about their critical eye on this country. Do you want more edge? Do you want less edge? How much do you depend for your own opinion on that comes from the people who are writing and drawing critically? Let's take our first call from Medford, Massachusetts. Dean's on the line. Hi, Dean.
Well, hello, and congratulations, Matt Davey.
I recognize that
and
voice.
What a great program you have.
All right, you better identify yourself, Dean.
Excuse me. I'm Dean Wallace, a former publisher of Editorial Humor, which started in 1989, and I believe was one of the first contests that Matt ever won was Editorial Humor Cartoon Contest. Matter of fact, it was so long ago, it might have been called Boston Comic News.
It was the Boston Comic News, and yet, that's right, Dean was one of the first people to go out on a limb and put my stuff in publication.
Pretty remarkable, considering you were working in crayon at the time, I suppose.
Yeah, pretty much. Whatever it takes to get into publication.
What did you see? What did you see, Dean?
Yes.
What did you see back then, and what do you see now? I mean, when you're trying to zero in on something that you want to mark as working in a field where there's so much material to choose from, what are you looking for?
Well, two things. One is that he was just what that nasty letter to him described, you know, totally subversive and funny, you know, with that last-minute thing. I mean, Mom, adding, you know, that you're going one way, he gets you leaning one way, and then he hits you, and you go the other way. The other thing I'd like to say is when he won that cartoon contest, one of our things was that we had major editorial cartoonists, including Pulitzer Prize winners, as the judges. I ran the contest, but I did not judge. So it was professional cartoonists like like Tom Tolles, for example.
Right.
People who had won editorial cartoon contests, Rob Rogers, and you know, great cartoonists who were doing the judging, and they took one look, and he was singled out.
I've been a troublemaker from way back, have you, Matt?
Yeah.
You know what? One of the things that struck me about this, Dean, thanks for your call, is that you mentioned, or I read somewhere in my research file, that there's 80 editorial staff cartoonists in the country, in a country that has over 5,000 newspapers. Is that right?
Yeah, that's sort of the unofficial number. Somewhere around there, yeah. It's not more than 100.
Why
it's under
so
100.
Few?
I don't really know. I mean, I have no answers for you. I know there's more than that many people who would like to be doing editorial cartoons, working for a newspaper. Budgetary maybe, probably a combination of newspaper budgets.
Well, is it perhaps because somebody gets to buy you from a syndicate and they don't have to pay you benefits at the same time?
Syndication does have to a degree a detrimental effect on absolutely. Instead of hiring a cartoonist, you can buy 10, you can buy 100 syndicated cartoons. There is a big difference between having your own cartoonist and using syndicated material. I mean, I work out of Westchester, New York, and my newspaper runs my cartoons every day. I comment on things, local issues, New York State issues, about the governor and stuff, and also national and international issues. And it gets to the point where my readers, they're not, when I comment on a national topic, my readers aren't just seeing some guy from Chicago or some guy from Arkansas or whatever, commenting on the national issue. They're seeing their local guy's take on that issue. So there is much more of a conversation with the reader, and especially if you're used to reading, if you go to the editorial page and read my cartoons every day, you're going to kind of get a theme, whether it's about busted parking meters on Main Street. Not that I've done a cartoon on that anytime recently, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The war in Iraq. It's they're getting the local take on those issues, and the idea that I mean, I can understand maybe some editors are uncomfortable with kind of giving a little blank space on the editorial page to some guy or a girl, and here's a pen and, go for it, upset readers. Some people are squeamish about that. Personally, I think it shows, it just shows respect for the reader. Readers of newspapers are adults generally, especially on the editorial page. Readers are, tend to be, they can handle it. They can handle a little bit of controversy. They can handle somebody's, it's no different than a letter to the editor.
I'm getting this. And Dan, it would be the same thing with critical writing. I mean, what you would say commenting on cars and driving in Boston just wouldn't wash in the LA Times, would it?
No, not since the Big Dig.
none of us have to start our cars.
That's not over yet.
I don't know. I watched a documentary on it. It looks like a real mess up there. California is certainly a unique driving environment.
That's a charitable way of putting it.
Well, that explains a lot of the bullet holes in people's trunks. It is special, and I feel special. Usually I want to take a shower after I commute. This is a crazy city. It's a car capital of America and maybe even the world in some senses, but it is a lousy place to drive. So I don't commute. I actually live in the city proper, only about 8 or 9 minutes, which is about as long as my MG will run before I have to do another repair on it. So it sort of works out perfectly.
With me on the program this hour, Matt Davis of the Journal News, White Plains, New York, for his with his Pulitzer Prize, for his editorial cartoons on an array of topics, and Dan Neal of the LA Times for reviews of automobiles, blending technical expertise with offbeat humor in the criticism category. Thanks to the Pulitzer Committee. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And our question to you is whether or not you're relying on their eyes for your making it through your day. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Uh-oh, it's Bob calling. Hi, Bob. But just Raleigh. Do you know Dan's work?
Well, actually, I used to read him in NNO, and when he got, removed from office, I called him and said, "You're too funny for Raleigh. You're too funny. You need to work for a car driver. You got too much attitude." I don't know if he remembers that phone call.
Yes, I do. I remember it vividly. And I sincerely appreciate it. But I disagree. I think Raleigh's very funny.
I'm curious as to how you get your ideas for your stories. I mean, I'm a car guy. I love cars. I can't tell you how many cars I got. My neighbors hate me. The whole cul-de-sac is full.
So you're thinking about cars all the time, Bob.
I'm a car guy. I love cars.
Yeah.
How do you get your ideas for stories?
Well, you know, if I one of the things I try real hard to do is write a story that people who care nothing about cars will read. So, you know, this is a newspaper journalist mentality. Get them to the jump, the place where the story jumps to the inside page. If you can get people to the jump, you know, you've really done something. You know, I'd be amazed if anybody ever read any story to the end. Anyway, the way I get my ideas is, you know, I have this bonding moment with the vehicle. Like, for instance, today, I'm driving the new Chevy SSR pickup truck. It looks like it was designed by the Revell Model Company. You know, it's this kind of – it's like this faux hot rod pickup truck. And, you know, General Motors has been doing some great work lately, but this thing is ghastly. And I think that I would, you know, buy it, drive it around the block once, park it, and sell it. You know, and I think there will be a great secondary market like Fannie Mae mortgages for this vehicle. And so, you know, I have this moment with the car, and I kind of think about, well, what would it be like to buy it, and you know, and why is this vehicle being built? What appetite does this satisfy in the marketplace? And typically, because we live in a consumer society, you know, our consumer appetites are also cultural and sociological appetites, and you know, you don't have to be, you know, Foucault to figure this out. You know, it's just pretty much. You know, it's writ large.
1-800-423. Let me interrupt you, trample all over you here. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, this hour we're talking with Matt Davis, editorial cartoonist, and Dan Neal, critical automobile writer from the LA Times. I can't decide whether or not it's a job or it's a program about the critical eye or listening to two people describe the jobs that we all wish we had. None of us are talented enough to do it. 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. This hour, we're talking about the Pulitzers and the critical eye. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Pub.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Matt Davis, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. His drawings appear in the Journal News of White Plains, New York, and elsewhere in syndication. Dan Neal won this year's Pulitzer for criticism. He writes for the automotive section of the L.A. Times. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join us this hour. I'm thinking both of you, and I want you to take this in the most positive way possible, that it's kind of a delightful accident that you both win the prize because it's automotive writing. It's not like, I don't know, what the other ones were, architectural criticism and deep thoughtful stuff that lists the names of other philosophers. And the other one comes from the Journal News, which is kind of a nice, happy thing to have a cartoonist win from a small paper. I don't know. Am I off base on this?
You first, Matt.
No, not at all. It was, it was the first Pulitzer Prize for my newspaper.
They were
finalists, I think twice before in other categories, but, you know, never won. So yeah, it was like a small explosion came from the newsroom, which woke me up at around 3 o'clock, and it was amazing. It was unbelievable. I mean, really, real morale booster. When you see the list of Dan, you know, no offense, you work for a newspaper that won 5 Pulitzers this time around, and you know, we're up against papers like the LA Times and New York Times and all the big guys. And so, yeah, and we actually are, you know, at my newspaper functions kind of in the shadow of the New York Times. We're in the same, partially the same circulation area. And, you know, but although one thing that the New York Times doesn't have that the Journal News does have is a cartoonist. So, you know, that helps. I'm still trying to figure out why they won't hire a cartoonist. I know it's not the money, but anyway, that I mean, it was a tremendous feeling to win for my newspaper. I mean, and yeah, the celebration was amazing, and I've never seen so many, you know, normally kind of, you know, angry looking journalists, you know, kind of mumbling around the newsroom. All of a sudden, they all lit up and were running around, and you know, and then of course we, you know, broke the company policy on alcohol being in the.
Well, you stopped drinking during the day, or what?
Yeah,
I was going to say
we officially broke.
Switched to hard liquor, I guess.
Yeah, right. And yeah, it was tremendous, and everybody's still really, really excited about it. It's fantastic. It was really good.
Dan,
yes.
Hello. I'm just wondering what you know. Whether this isn't the sort of critical writing that I have to tell you. In most of the newspapers that I look at, I don't read the automotive stuff because it sucks. It's like ad copy, oh, masquerading. No, it is. It's
no. I'm telling you, yes, that's true. However, let me just say. First of all, this is the first I'm the first automotive critic to receive Pulitzer, and I think in criticism I'm only the second non-arts reviewer to win it. I think David Shaw at the LA Times won it in 1983 for media criticism. So yes, it is a little it's different, and it is also true that there's a great unwashed many writers out there working in automotive journalism who aren't all that good. On the other hand, there are some brilliant writers working in this field, and I'm probably not the best of them. I can name you three guys: Brock Yates, or John Phillips, Jamie Kittman, Aaron Robinson. There are guys out there who have got game, and any one of those guys could have won the Pulitzer. I think that basically, you know, well, for one thing, I think I made the jury laugh. And if you're on the Pulitzer committee, it's, you know, it's probably not all that funny. That made a big difference. And, you know, I think they were looking for something different. And I think it's an acknowledgement that, you know, that criticism means more than just dance, music, theater, film.
Right, right. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. Let's go to Boston, Massachusetts. Dan's on the line. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. I just want to say congratulations to Matt and Dan. I just did a 12,000-mile road trip in a 1951 Hudson, Dan. And it was to personify the love affair of Americans have with the road. I'm wondering, do you think that the love is lost, that we're in a long-term commitment now with no more love, and we'll never be in love with the cars like we were in the 50s?
It depends. You know, I think that it's out there for people who want to grab hold of it. I tell you what, if I drove a gigantic 3-ton SUV to work every day, I wouldn't be in love with the automobile. I would think that it's, you know, it's like the black hole of Calcutta. Then people don't realize, you know, driving is a lot of fun, but not if you're driving a bus. And you know, it's true that automobiles are increasingly problematic, given the situation in the Middle East and the ozone layer and so forth. But I think that driving, being out on the road driving, is still a sublime experience, and it's, you know, and it may be one of those things that only we in the 20th and 21st century, you know, this is a particular guilty pleasure that in history that we will enjoy, and you know, generations thereafter won't. But yeah, I think so. I think people, Americans, still love the road.
1-800-423-8255. Still in Boston, only we're talking with Paul now. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you. First, I'd like to say about editorial cartoons, I wish they would be stronger. I read the English papers from England regularly, and the cartoons there are much harder hitting against both Blair and Bush, and stuff we don't see here. And, of course, it's easy for me to say because I won't get suspended by an editor or boycotted by a publisher.
Right.
You know, owns and is very in close with the government. But I wish they would get stronger because it's a great counterpoint to photo ops and lies. And that's my point. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Matt, yeah. Is he right? Are the cartoonists in Britain nastier?
Yeah. Well, I'm originally from England, so like I said, English. You know, maybe it's cultural. I don't know, but I'd be curious to know what the listener meant by stronger, because my criticisms are unedited, and I consider them to be pretty strong. Strong enough to get letters like the one that you read in the previous
right.
Part of the program. The only difference I'm trying to be diplomatic here about it. A lot of the cartoons I see coming from England aren't very. They may be strong, but they're not very clever, and they're not that. They just don't make you think. They're just like, okay, well, here's my opinion, and I don't have any in front of me that I can sort of pull out. There are a couple of cartoonists in England, I'm just talking about. That's a blanket statement. There's one cartoonist in particular from the UK, however, his name's Steve Bell, and he works for The Guardian. And he's brilliant. He's a brilliant cartoonist, but he has, there's a completely different cultural sensibility in England with regard to what's acceptable in a daily newspaper. And, you know, for instance, he includes flatulence, drawn in a cartoon. I mean, he'll draw Tony Blair, or George Bush indulging in some flatulence, and... I've been trying to get that past my editors for years, and they just, hey, pal, this is America. You can't draw flatulence in a family newspaper. So, I don't know if that's strong.
The rule is who reads the newspaper. It's not really a rule about how mean you can be or how hard hitting you can be towards a particular politician.
Yeah, maybe there's a slightly more puritanical bent to this country in general compared to England, and I've seen a lot of the other European in other European countries. There's a lot harder edge. That's a cultural sociological difference that I couldn't even begin to address. Maybe I could draw a few cartoons about it, but I can't talk about it. I wouldn't even know where to begin. All I know is that my actual criticisms of Bush are exactly the same as somebody who's say, for instance, drawing flatulence. It's just that I choose not to use that, or my editor chooses for me not to use that. And frankly, there's other a lot more creative ways of disagreeing. Showing that you disagree with somebody. I'm not sure that I buy the. Well, no, you know what? There probably are. The cartoons in Europe are probably. More obnoxious, but I'm not sure that
sort of like
more
the difference
critical.
Between Playboy and Penthouse when we were growing
yeah,
up.
Yeah, exactly. Like the subtle differences between Playboy and Penthouse. Yeah, a lot more airbrushing over here.
Dan, are there rules that you either impose on yourself or your editors? I'm assuming you have an editor now, don't you?
Yeah. I think that was part of the deal.
I mean, your writing is. A little bit like editorial cartooning in that you like the loopy and you like the sort of wake up and pay attention type stuff. Does it mean that there are places where you can't go because you're writing in a family paper?
Well, in automotive journalism, traditionally, because of what was an incestuous relationship between the manufacturers and the people who reviewed the cars, basically this is, the charge is that automotive journalists soft pedal their criticism of vehicles, couch it in the most polite terms possible. That's the big rap that you would represent in some way the manufacturer's interests over those of the readers. I don't do that. But in all honesty, that's because I work for the Los Angeles Times, which is in a position to have very, very high journalistic standards. There are a lot of smaller newspapers struggling to survive. Out there who can't who are afraid to alienate their advertising base, and so yeah, they do soft pedal their criticism of automobiles, and it's kind of a larger question about the state of journalism and the old church state division. As far as any other kinds of issues, no, I feel pretty free to roam far and wide. One of the things I think that people like is that, I'll talk about cars and talk about art and art history and aesthetics and philosophy and physics, and kind of, you know, weave it all together in a way that's surprising. I think, was it James Burke who wrote, with all due respect to the name of your program, didn't he write the Connections column?
Yeah, what got me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, back in Scientific American. Anyway, so that's something I think that people like, and I've never had an editor say, "Whoa, this is a little too much of a reach." Maybe they should have, but they haven't so far.
Let me take a quick last call from Plattsburgh, New York. Jerome's on the line. Hi, Jerome.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What's your question?
Well, I don't have a question. I have a suggestion I may for the cartoonist.
Yeah.
In reference to the up-and-coming hearing of September 11th with Bush and Cheney being interviewed at the same time.
Yeah.
And I would suggest, and since I can't draw, I would suggest that they have a puppet, and one puppet controlling the other to kind of show that who's controlling the show and who's really talking.
You know what? Somebody already did that.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. So, but good idea.
I'm sorry, but you haven't.
I just saw it.
Listening to it.
You guys must have so many people who sort of come up and say, "Hey, I've got a good idea. Why don't you write a piece about it? Why don't
you draw it?"
No, it's not, is it?
No, it's like, wherever you are, somebody has an idea for you, and I've heard this somewhere before, but it's sort of like. I couldn't imagine going up to a surgeon at a party or something saying, you know, I got a really great idea for a bypass kind of alternative. You know, like it just doesn't – it's like people think that because it's so accessible, you know, like that they can do it. But, you know, and I got to say sometimes people give good ideas, but generally I don't have a shortage of my own. So it's – you know, you can be very polite and put an idea aside. But, you know, if I had to rely on other people for ideas, I'd be in a lot of trouble.
All right, both of you. Listen, congratulations. Matt Davis, it was great to have you on the program. Thanks for being with us.
Likewise. Thank you, Dick.
Matt won this year's Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. His drawings appear in the Journal News of White Plains, New York. There is a collection, a little gallery of them on our website at theconnection.org. Dan Neal, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Dick. It's a pleasure.
Dan won this year's Pulitzer for criticism. He writes for the automotive section of the LA Times, and there are also a couple of links on our website to his work as well. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.